Blog Talk Radio.
Today is Thursday, July 30th, 2009. This is your host, Doug Kelly, here with Grant Rubendunz. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Doug. Welcome, everybody. Happy Thursday night.
Yes, good to have everybody join us tonight. We were concerned there at the last minute about I was trying to call into Blog Talk, and it was giving me an issue. And so we're glad to connect. And tonight, we are going to welcome our guest, Stephen Mather-Lees, author, and going to have an interesting discussion about where we came from based on his book and his research. If you'd like to join us in the chat room, we'd love to have you. If you'd like to call in and ask questions, we'd love to have you do that too. I'm going to paste the number in the chat room. It is there on your screen. And if you have a headset, you can use that click the talk button on your screen. So let's talk about our guest tonight. Stephen Mather-Lees is the author of Who the Bleep Designed Us. Stephen was educated in England at Cambridge and holds an MA in mechanical sciences. He has been a career engineer since the 1970s and is widely experienced in computer technology and software. He has a longtime interest in the mind, space travel, science fiction, cosmology, philosophy, and comparative religion. He is currently working on his next book, The E.T. Gods, A Proposed Dialogue. He is married with two grown daughters. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Doug. Glad to be here.
Yeah, and I might add he's also a Paranexus member. That's the best thing there.
So nice to have you on board.
Yeah. So you're talking to us from southern New Hampshire, you said, right?
That's right.
And you're originally from England. The northern part, did you say, or what neck of the woods there?
No, southern England. I was brought up in Surrey and lived in southern England the whole of the time I was there.
I lived in England the entire time I lived in England? I'm just kidding you.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding you. All right, so Stephen's website is whothebleepdesignedus.com. If you want to take a look at that, some interesting stuff there, and I'll put that in the chat room as well. So, Stephen, kind of bring us up to speed a little bit on, why the book, Who the Bleep Designed Us? What started that?
Well, I just started noticing the tremendous pace of development in science and technology and bioengineering, and just started to extrapolate where that was taking us. If we look ahead a few hundred years, where is it going? And I realized that it's going so rapidly that even if the rate of progress stays the same, in a couple of hundred years, we would be able to design ourselves. And when we start thinking about that as well, we take that in conjunction with the fact that we clearly are not alone in the universe. There's got to be plenty of beings around that would be capable of doing that too, and would have been capable of it for probably millions of years. So that raises the possibility that our evolution was assisted.
Can I ask you to speak up just a little bit, Stephen?
Yeah,
thank you. So interesting. So how long ago did you begin your book or working on your book?
I started about 8 years ago, and I was going to say also that when you also start to take a look at evolution, there's a few things that make one wonder about whether it's as simple as Charles Darwin proposed. And there's things like, well, if we only use a few percent of our brains, how would evolution have done that and why? And what's the rest of it there for? That just doesn't stack with
how
we understand it.
I have to agree with you there.
And there's lots of evidence for the fact that we only use a few percent of our brains. When you look at people with Savant syndrome, for instance, who have these incredible memories or these abilities to play the piano or...
the idiot savants.
So the implication is that we all have those capabilities if we only knew how to access them. And again, why is all that ability buried?
So what is your thinking on that?
It's just an indicator that that there is this huge potential in our brains and minds that we're not using, and we have to wonder why it's there, and it's an indicator of why evolution doesn't really, cannot have worked quite the way conventional science thinks it does.
Do you think, Stephen, that possibly our genetic, the genetic components that are part of us are possibly on some sort of, for lack of better words, on a time release, so that, you know, it's constantly evolving, in a sense?
It easily could be. I don't think we have enough of a timeline to be able to say at this point, but... certainly things have changed in the last few hundred years. We're certainly living longer, for instance, but that may be just diet and...
Well, certainly with the advances in biochemistry, I can certainly see the day that we would be, you know, regenerating limbs and possibly regrowing organs and that sort of thing, and certainly would push us, if not there, but close to the brink of immortality. I don't see that coming. Like, I would share the same view with you. It's going to be a couple hundred years away, but it's most definitely coming. But what it makes me wonder about, maybe perhaps, you know, you could elaborate on this, and if it was part of your theory, is whether or not, you know, maybe I'm beginning to wonder if not the DNA is universal, and that, you know, it just, you know, depending on the components on a certain planet, if all the characteristics are right, certain life forms will evolve, and you know, they may have a common shape or form simply because that's, you know, they may have four legs because that's the most feasible. But but I'm kind of wondering,
okay, well,
perhaps we were seeded.
That's a definite possibility. You just have to find out more. But I guess what I don't see is really concerted effects by effort rather by the academic community to study it. There's a few people, great souls like ourselves, who are wondering and doing what we can, but if the universities really started to work on this, I think we'd see some good progress pretty quickly.
Why do you think they're so reluctant to do so?
My sense is that people tend to have very narrow fields of study. I've met a few people, like Rudy Shield, who wrote the foreword to my book, who do go outside of their field. Edgar Mitchell is another good example. But they're rare. Most academics stay in their own field and don't talk much to people outside it. So you don't get this integrating type of a viewpoint that I'm trying to put over here.
Or they may be competing in other areas that they think might be more lucrative, or the granting funds are going in a certain direction.
Talks, if there are not grants available to study alternatives to standard evolution, then probably it's not going to get studied very much.
So,
the way academia works.
So tell us about, you know, you had four different issues that you talked about in your book. Can you repeat those and tell us kind of what you explored?
One of the things that got me going was the rate of advance in bioengineering, the rate of advance in science and technology in general, the fact that we only use a few percent of our brains. You can argue about how many percent it is, but it's got to be a whole lot less than 50. And that we're clearly not alone in the universe, or indeed in this section of the galaxy. It's just too much evidence.
Okay.
So, I think the 5% of our brain leads us into, leads me anyway, into really questioning if whether evolution works the way the conventional wisdom has it working.
Okay, so what way do you think it works? Or do you, are you, what are some speculation?
I have to say, well, if evolution doesn't work the way we think it works, maybe somebody helped it along. Well, you know, there has to be a reason why it took this different, or this unlikely path where it gave us a mental capacity way beyond what we actually use.
Okay, we'll start then at the kind of the beginning of this. You say that there's too much evidence for life beyond Earth. What are you basing that on? What makes that real for you?
Well, I think your own website is a good example of many websites and books and writings that indicate that that's what's going on. They're being visited by not one, but many races. Statistically, there have to be many, many races around in the galaxy. If you run the numbers, almost by any set of criteria, you come up with hundreds of thousands of probable intelligent races in this galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
What would their, just out of curiosity, Stephen, what would their interest be in us? What would their interest be in us? Let's assume that there's a spacefaring civilization.
Here's a race that's just emerging. I mean, when you think about how recent all of this is, we're just emerging from babyhood in the cosmic sense to maybe being ready for the kindergarten. And that's got to be interesting for the people who have already evolved beyond that. I think it's an event.
So they might be viewing us more as sort of like we would view, you know, some native tribe in the Amazon, some, you know, isolated, as more like an anthropological thing to learn from us, perhaps.
Yeah, and the indication is that the interest is a benign one. If it was not a benign one, I think we would have been had signs of this a long time ago.
Okay, what we're going to do is we are going to, your volume, Stephen, is really low. It's gotten a little bit worse, so. Let's. We're going to try something. I'm going to just play a musical interlude for everybody for just a minute. If you'll hang with us, we're going to see what we can do to increase that volume a little bit. So hang with us. We'll be right back. All right, folks, we're going to give this a shot, see if we can make the volumes a little bit better.
Told you about playing with that Ouija board, Doug. You know, it's been a long time, but boy, you know.
Yeah, I know it. I have to.
Got the Skype gods all riled tonight.
Yeah. Sorry. All right. So we're talking with Stephen Mader-Lees, the author of Who the Bleep Designed Us. His website is whothebleepdesignedus.com. And we're talking about genetic engineering. Now, Stephen, you talk about the fact that we're only using a percentage of our full capacity, that there's other life, obviously. I mean, and I'm with you. I mean, you'd have to be. I don't even know what you'd have to be to think that we're it. The universe is just too extensive. And so you're questioning the Darwinian evolution, as it were, and you're looking at, okay, what could have happened? So in your estimation, are you aware of any evidence that there might be some DNA engineering going on here?
In terms of evidence, all there really is, for sure, is writings such as those ones that have been unearthed by Zechariah Sitchin about ancient Sumeria and the Mayans and the Celts and the Hindus and the Norse and the Greeks and the Egyptians all have the same kind of story about gods coming down from the sky, interbreeding, doing various things, and that to me, that's pretty good evidence that all of those ancient civilizations would have essentially the same story. It's just too good to be true. I mean, well, not too good to be true. I mean, it probably is true.
Well, you know, I mean, so what you're doing, this is the thing that's interesting to me, because what you're telling us here is that we were basically engineered by aliens. Isn't that what you're saying?
I think there's a good probability. I'm not saying that's the whole story or the story. I think it's worth taking a good look at.
Now, this is
evidence around to justify it as a field of study.
Now, this is an interesting thing. This is just a sidebar, if you will. I'm thinking here. You know, we're right, Doug. You know, we're engineered by aliens. That's who made us here. I mean, how weird does that sound? That's like way out there. And then I kind of compare that with what I used to believe, that there were these two people. One was a woman named Eve, and a snake talked to her, and they lost it for all humanity. I'm thinking, well, which one, you know, which one's more way out there? And so, you know, it's just interesting to me that, you know, that this concept of genetic engineering is what's the word I'm looking for? It's as real as anything. I mean, it's as good as any other that we're currently using.
So we've already proved in recent years that genetic engineering is possible, and we're doing it. We're doing it to animals. We're doing it to crops. It's here now. So it's not whether it's feasible or not. But, well, was it in fact used in our case, as we were at some stage, or even maybe several stages of our evolution? And I suspect that the signs are there if there's a concerted effort to go out there and look for them.
Yep. All right. So, in your book, how's it set up? In terms of your, I'm assuming, because I haven't read your book, but I'm assuming that you've laid it out logically, that this is what we're working with here, and these are some of the indicators. Is that how you've done it?
Yes. Yeah. There's a chapter on why I think evolution has some holes in it. There's a chapter on why I think the evidence is of why we're not alone. I go in a little bit into the statistics, the good old Drake equation, and how that might be modified in the light of what we found out since we did it in the 60s.
What's your basic argument, Stephen, against evolution?
Well, it's not against evolution. I think evolution works perfectly well. I just think it had some help in our case.
So it was possibly accelerated?
Yes, accelerated or
diverted, enhanced or whatever.
Accelerated. And it's impossible to say that if you believe the Sumerian writings, there's definitely some engineering took place about 20,000 years ago. And the other ancient religions seem to have about the same time frame, as far as you can get a time frame from their writings.
And so some of that you base on the theories of Zachariah Sitchin, some of his works?
Yes, I think he makes a very persuasive case that something was going on with extraterrestrial visitors during that time. When,
mm-hmm. Because I know the Sumerians talked about how they had the extraterrestrial that came to them and taught them agriculture and mathematics and some other things. And even Carl Sagan, I'm trying to remember, he did a book in the 70s, Intelligent Life in the Universe, in collaboration with a Russian astronomer, I can't recall his name, where they had a chapter that was devoted to that showed the actual cuneiform and some actual kind of raised sculptures or motifs that show that. So that is very interesting.
Yeah, and there are pictures and even models of things that look remarkably like aircraft and spaceships to be seen.
You know, the only difficulty I have with Zachariah Sitchin's theory is with the fact that if you had and I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate here, if you had an advanced species, whether humanoid or whatever, that was coming to Earth to mine Earth for its precious minerals and everything else, it would seem to me that the least logical way to go about mining those minerals would be through human or genetically engineered slaves. I would think that any culture that's sophisticated enough to fly in between the planets or to fly in between galaxies would have some type of automated mining machinery.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I mean, why would they want to genetically manipulate humans? To what? How would that be advantageous to them?
Well, I think it's not clear that that's one of the things that came out of his writings, that the idea was to produce people to go and do the mining for them.
AKA slaves.
It's entirely clear to me that's the case. It just seems clear that some engineering went on, and I think it's up to us to find out what that was.
I'm not disputing, you know, that was just a point for me that I always had a little bit of trouble with, but then again, I suppose, Stephen, what you could say is, well, no, I don't think so. I think that the other side of that coin is that one could say, well, how could you fathom the mind of an alien? Because we don't know what their motives are. We don't even know what their motives are now, especially we can't even communicate with dolphins, let alone communicate with a sophisticated alien culture that may be a million years ahead of us on an evolutionary scale. So,
yes.
Who knows? It may even be a moot point.
Yes, I mean, there is a whole lot of work to do, and, you know, when we think about what we might be able to do in 200 years, and then try to get our heads around what somebody who's a million years ahead of us might be thinking or capable of, it's daunting. It's very daunting.
Mm-hmm.
So did you draw any conclusions?
If you even go back to the 1920s and look at some of the predictions of what was going to happen in the next 50 years, it's a joke. And that's only 50 years.
Yeah.
Well, look at Stanley Kubrick, 2001. By 2001, we were supposed to have bases on the moon. And, I mean, you know what? We're a long, long ways away from that.
Yeah, I'm afraid we are. One of the sad, really sad things, because I remember when I was a child, people were predicting that there was no way we would get to the moon before the year 2000.
Yep.
We were on it in the 60s, and then we did a bunch of things and then abandoned it.
It's really too bad, because had we continued on the path that we were on, we had all the right machinery and everything else, we could have had a moon base a long time ago. Maybe all the money that we spent on the shuttle was not worth it in the long run, because here we are going back to trying to go back to the past with a more beefed up Apollo program that, is, as I'm sure you're well aware of, Stephen, is not living up to expectations and maybe falling apart right before our very eyes.
Yes, it is.
And then where that's going to lead the International Space Station is going to be very interesting.
Yeah.
So, Stephen, on your book, what were you able to draw any conclusions? I mean, any logical conclusions or logical speculations on, I mean, what's your evidence? Let's put it this way. Let's say that I think that this whole concept of potential alien engineering is bunk and it's BS. What would you say to convince me? I mean, what's your line of reasoning? What's your research? How would you relate to that? Or how would you respond to that, rather?
I guess I would respond by saying that I'm really not trying to tell everybody the way it is. I guess my goal is to get people to think about it and to do some more research. There are good indicators that ETs have been here for a long time, that they've had some interactions and some involvement.
And what are those?
Probably beyond doubt if you have an open mind. So the question whether they did or did not do some engineering on our DNA is perhaps an open question. There's a certain amount of evidence about it, which I think makes it worth studying in more detail. So that's what I would say. Convincing people to change their minds, especially about something that's part of religious thinking,
mm-hmm.
is a very difficult task.
That's way too threatening for a lot of people, Stephen. You know, they don't want that. That's too big of a paradigm shift, and I don't think we're anywhere near that yet.
The vast majority of people, you're absolutely right, but I think this just has to be incremental. As more and more people who are willing to be open-minded start to look at the questions, come to their own conclusions, talk with each other, get involved in some research, join organizations like yours.
There you go. That's Paranexus.org.
Gradually get there, I think, and that's the best we can hope for. And some people are never going to believe it. There's still people around who believe the Earth is flat.
Well, you know, I can recall in my mind seeing programs about UFOs, and they were talking about the history of UFO conventions. And some of these tapes were taken in the 1950s. And the one thing that always struck me as a young person, I kept saying, you know, evidence is right around the corner. And, you know, it really kind of rattled me when I watched one of these old films of the 50s, and one of the guys pronounced, almost in my own words, you know, evidence is right around the corner. We're waiting for this incredible evidence to be released, or it's going to be happening soon. And, you know, that was probably filmed in the 1950s. And you know, we're still waiting for that. And I think, you know, without sounding negative, I'm not so sure we're going to ever get that.
Well, I'm with you on that.
It's much too complex.
We're almost getting into the next book now.
mm-hmm.
I think we need to start letting go of that. The government is probably never going to own up to all of the stuff that's gone on. And we need to start looking forward. How can we participate? How can we...
Well, which is even a more scary thought, because what that would lead me to believe is, and this is just maybe, you know, call me crazy, but if that's truly the case, and they have to continue to hide something, then that sends up red flags for me, because that basically says they're out of control, or they don't know what's going on, or they, you know, can't get it, or what they do know, they don't, it frightens them. So
I think that's probably true. I think this bogey of national security has been behind the thinking all along.
Mm-hmm.
And it's best to keep it all under wraps until they feel like they have their heads around it, and that's really not happened yet.
Yeah, and it probably won't happen anytime soon, because I think that the people who are, without sounding like, you know, a world conspiracy person, which I'm not, I don't think the Bilderbergers run the world, but by the same token, I think maybe corporations have a hand in how the way things go, and possibly if the structure of society was rattled somehow with a big paradigm shift, they would feel very threatened by that. However, I think, and Doug and I have talked about this before, Stephen, I think that if they landed on the White House lawn, everything would stop for about a week or two, and then everything would go right back to normal. People would still go to church. People would still believe what they wanted to believe. And you know what? The novelty would be over.
Give it 50 years and it never happened.
Yeah, you know, and like the Brookings report with it, every civilization has collapsed when a more advanced civilization comes in contact with a lesser advanced civilization. Well, you know what? Maybe that wouldn't be the case. But maybe that's part of the root of the fear.
Yeah, certainly there's a huge resistance to change at all levels. And that would be a very dramatic paradigm shift, as you say. So
what do you think, Stephen?
Some of us look at it with interest and excitement and wanting to know what's going to happen. And but most people would be scared, yes.
So what do you think? You know, you've had a chance to think about this for some years. You've written your book, Who the Bleep Designed Us. You know, you've done your research. What do you think? You know, what do you think in terms of genetic engineering? Who do you think they are? What's your own belief system? Where is it at right now?
Oh, I'm not sure I've really zeroed in on one. I'm just fascinated by the whole subject, and I'm continually learning. So, if I had to place a bet on what's really happened and is happening? I tend to think that there was some engineering in the past, maybe several times, maybe by different groups. I mean, if you think of people advancing as rapidly as we're advancing, and then, you know, look out hundreds or thousands of years, if we did do some genetic engineering on another race, let's say in 300 years or so, we go out and find a planet somewhere and pull around this their DNA, would we still be interested in doing that 1,000 years later or 10,000 years later, or would we move on to something completely different?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wonder that about whoever did engineering on us. Are they still interested? Are they still involved? Have they gone somewhere else? The people that are coming here now might be different groups altogether. In fact, I suspect they probably are. Otherwise, why would these medical examinations and experiments that appear to go on with abductees, the people that designed us would not need to do that, would they?
Yeah, probably not.
Experimentation long ago. This is a bunch of you guys, I think.
But what if, let's take it from a different angle, what if you were coming to this planet as somebody who wanted to colonize the planet? And I think one of the interesting things is, if you're approaching this planet and you're up in orbit, in a parked orbit around the Earth, you could tell with your technology the places on Earth that would be the best places to start a colony, the richest, most fertile plains, like in the Nile, the Tigris and the Euphrates. That would be visible from space. And if a spacefaring culture came here and colonized, and let's say that they came here not, you know, 40,000 years ago, but what about 500,000 years ago? And we were like, just barely walking around dragging our knuckles. You know, maybe there might have been something, maybe they might have seen something in us, or maybe they were humanoid and maybe they did something to accelerate something for whatever reason. Maybe they didn't slave us. Who knows? But when you think of it from that standpoint, it really raises some interesting possibilities.
It certainly does. And my thought is that different groups of ETs might have come at different stages of the process, including half a million years ago, and maybe they decided to make the change that went from invertebrates to vertebrates. It's a little hard to understand that evolutionary jump.
Yeah.
You know, completely different body structure. Well, why? And how would they breed with each other?
Well, you know, I think you, and you probably agree with me on this, Stephen, I think that one of the things that I find where I back away from evolution is for many years, traditional evolutionists said it was a very slow process. It was very well thought out by nature, yada, 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 yada. And then you get stuff like weird stuff, and I think it was in the Precambrian, and I think one of the creatures was just like completely against what logic would dictate. I think the name of the creature, and you might know the name, it was an Amamalacaris. But it was this odd concoction where evolution just threw some oddball stuff in the mix, and it was completely out of the range of what most traditional evolutionary theory would have said would happen. So I think we can never discount that part.
No, well, one of my flights of fancy has been that many of the animals that we see around look like studies done by mediocre graduate students at some kind of a cosmic university. They were just fooling around, seeing what they could create. I mean, look at the peacock.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of ridiculous thing. I mean, it can hardly fly. It's very ungainly. It's an easy mark for any predator. I mean, why would something evolve like that?
So you had about a lot of...
Look at lots of animals, and you wonder, like the 17-year locust. I mean, what kind of a survival mechanism is that? It's kind of crazy. There's just lots of them. If you start to look around and think, how did that evolve?
Well,
it makes no sense.
It's simple. God did it.
Well, the gardeners did it, too,
as I said,
you know?
One of the opening paragraph of my book says, it really looks to me as if there is a personal God, they must have a really right sense of humor.
Yeah.
And God laughed.
Yeah. And that was a laugh. You saw them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, cool. So, people can find your book at whothebleepdesignist.com, correct?
Actually, no. If they want to buy it, it's on Amazon.com.
Okay.
The website does not actually sell the book. It'll tell you about it. It'll invite you to discuss it. There's a discussion board. You can sign up and be a part of the new book in terms of reviewing the ideas, taking part in the discussions that will lead to it. Actual purchasing, you need to go to Amazon.com, and one or two local bookstores are starting to carry it up in New England. But Amazon is the place.
Okay.
You can do a search on Who the Bleep or on my name, and you'll get right to it.
Okay. So, what was it that really inspired you to write this book? Other than, you know, hey, I think this, but what was the message you're trying to get out with this book? You know, the purpose. What was your purpose in writing it?
I see it as inviting discussion, integrating the subject in a way that just brings all the different disciplines together and says, well, look, you put all this stuff together, there's something that's really worth thinking about here. And that's really as far as it goes. I just would like to see it researched. I'd like to see it discussed. And outside, beyond, I would say, the UFO community or the ET community, I think there's enough open-minded people around that it can go a little beyond that now, and that's my goal.
Okay, cool. So, I had a question. It just escaped me. All right, so here it is. What do you think should be done, or do you have any ideas on what should be done to gain more information on potential genetic engineering or revisiting the evolutionary process? Is it just getting more disciplines together? Is that what you're...
Yeah, I think there's not enough interdisciplinary work going on in the universities. I think people, as I was saying earlier, people stick to their own field of study, and it's a rare professor that goes outside of their chosen field. And I'd like to see the university put together a team, you know, engineers, physicists, cosmologists, biologists, paleontologists, and get them working together and exchanging ideas. That, as far as I can tell, that just does not go on in the universities.
We were talking about that last week on our special on reinventing the anomalous research field, about how so much research is tied to products, producing products, whether it's in the pharmaceuticals industry or in some other industry where research can eventually lead to a product and therefore money. And so you've got so much driving that.
Absolutely. So maybe we should be thinking about how somebody can make some money out of it. So.
Well, maybe one day.
Well, technologies will certainly there will be technologies coming out of this at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We'll wait till they figure out how to genetically make medications that are effective and delivery systems for the genetic medications, and they're going to do it with nanotechnology.
That's kind of already going.
They are. There are ways from perfecting it, but we're not that far away from. Where everything's going to be done at a molecular level. So, the thing I find most fascinating about the DNA is the fact that, for me, I find it a great comfort in the fact that our DNA isn't that dissimilar from, you know, a field rodent or a field mouse or a grasshopper to some degrees. So, you know what? In that, there's like, wow. We're indigenous to this wonderful, incredible planet. And maybe the DNA is unique to this planet, but maybe it's seeded throughout the universe, and on the right type of, wherever it's sowed in the right places, it grows life. And that DNA can evolve, and it's unique to whatever the characteristics of that planet are.
Yeah, well, certainly DNA is obviously versatile enough to be able to build just about any kind of an animal, or more than a template, it's a little computer because it has these timed release things. You know, you go through your first beat, your second beat, puberty, all of that, and you get old. So it's a very advanced little computer.
So who's Johnny Appleseed? Who's Johnny Appleseed out there that's spreading us all around? Maybe that's the great mystery, and maybe that's the thing that we need to truly worship is whoever the gardener is.
I have to say, from science fiction, David Brin in his Uplift series, whereby races of beings have to see it as part of their mission to bring along people who are, you know, starting to achieve sentience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an interesting and fairly persuasive model for what really might be going on.
Well, I also like what your fellow countryman Arthur Clark used to talk about. The benevolent, but also, you know, I'm really not, but disinterested gardener who, you know, had his own agenda, and we fit in where we fit in. It wasn't necessary that we knew what his agenda was.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
It's part of the mystery.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, I came to this through science fiction because I realized that science fiction authors are some of the best thinkers and philosophers of our time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Heinlein put some wonderful thinking in his book.
Yeah.
And Clark, too, of course. David Brin, I like his ideas. There's lots of them.
Ray Bradbury.
Yep.
The master, Ray Bradbury.
Stephen, what do you attribute the rapid growth of knowledge to in the last 100 or so years? Any conclusions there or speculations? Hey, hang on just a second. I think we're losing your connection a little bit there. You try it again. We'll see if we got you. There we go.
I think it's that it seems to be a sort of a snowball effect, because every discipline you look at, whether it's medicine or computers or bioengineering or aeronautics or space, they're all on an exponential growth curve. Not at different rates, of course, but a lot of it is to do with how easy it is to get feedback on your experiments. And but they're all on an exponential growth curve, and that doesn't seem to be a coincidence. It's maybe that there are just more people involved doing those things, and interactions build on themselves or something, but it's really happening.
Here's a question from the chat room. Stephen, do you think that Greys are the ones that have initially manipulated the DNA and are still doing this?
I think it's too early to speculate on who originally did it.
What about currently? Do you think there's...
Some people seem to think the Greys are actually artifacts themselves. They're actually working for a different race.
Mm-hmm.
It's too early to say whether that's true or not. I've also seen that there seem to be several different races that you could describe as grays of different sizes. Anything from 8 feet tall down to 3 feet tall. So I don't know. I hope I live long enough to see us find out.
Yeah, me too. That would be cool. So interesting stuff. There's, when you get into this philosophically and you look at everything that there is, and that's really what we've been talking about for the last 50 minutes or so, is, where do we come from? The big three questions, right? Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? The quest to understand those questions. And we look at history, we look at evolution, we look at all the belief systems. And to me, this is just my own opinion, it's just that all of the religions out there, everything is there to try to answer those questions and fit it into a paradigm or fit it into a box that we can deal with, that we can touch and hold and handle and feel good about. And not only that, but gives us hope, because I think hope, or the need for hope, is certainly a part of human nature and a big one at that. And people need hope. They need something to look at. And so we've got all these different theories out there that we're still trying to figure out. And as technology increases, we are figuring a few things out. And it's a fascinating aspect. Of course, many have gone through it. I've gone through it, being very religious for the first 40 years of my life and not for the last 10. Looking at things in different ways and trying to connect. But, when you talk about life in the universe, that's, at least within my awareness, that's, we're kind of getting to that point where a lot of people are really starting to embrace that concept more than in decades past. And if our listeners haven't done this, if you go to Google Earth and click on the Google Sky aspect of it and just go look at the universe, go look at some of those Hubble Space images, the galaxies, and look at the vastness and read some of the comments on these distant, like the Hubble Deep Field, where there's 10,000 galaxies and a little space in the sky that is about the same size as a penny from 75 feet away. It's amazing. And I can't wrap my brain around the fact that we're alone. That's just...
Well, the other thing is too, Doug and Steve, when Stan Freeman was on the show, I think a lot of people really don't realize this too. A lot of people go, the skeptics and the naysayers will go, look, it's the distance is too vast. You simply can't travel from point A to point B because of the size of the distance, and it's just something that's never going to happen. that kind of, although we may, well, I'm sorry, I kind of lost track of my thought there, fellas.
Well, that's okay. There's a question, another follow-up question in the chat room. Stephen,
come to me a second. Sorry, guys.
That's okay. Stephen, do you think that all the different species might be working together, that is alien species, working together, taking turns and changing the DNA of humans?
That's entirely possible. I get the impression from the reading I've done that there are many races of aliens involved visiting here. Some of them appear to be engaged in some way with us. Others appear to be simply observing. Some of them, I think, may be waiting for us to show enough maturity to be worth giving a little more information to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we ready for cosmic kindergarten?
I'm personally ready for contact, and I will reiterate my previous statement from shows past that if any alien species are, in fact, listening to this, or any spirit species, anybody, I'm completely open to contact. I won't freak. You know, if you can hear this, you know where I'm at. Show up. We'll chat. We'll do tea.
I'm 100% with you. I feel the same way. I would love to have a conversation. Seeing a UFO or something is interesting and fun and everything, but I would like to have a conversation with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole lot of questions I want to ask.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, we all do. All right, cool. We've only got a few minutes.
Doug, I know what I was going to say.
Go ahead, Grant.
What I was going to say is that what a lot of people don't realize is that even though there's vast distances between stars, there's probably 14 or 15 sun-like stars within 40 light years of this planet. Most people don't realize that.
Right.
If we got those capabilities, we could, you know, there's a lot of different places to visit that may already have civilizations that are close to us. 40 light years is a long ways now, but 200, 300 years from now, it may be just there.
Once we get that warp drive working.
Well, you know, you cranked up the Heisenberg converters a little while ago, Doug, to get speed back. So start working on it, dude.
The guy in charge that was in charge of the Skunk Works at Lockheed made a remark in California.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we can send ET home now, he said.
Mm.
Yeah.
There you go.
So we may already have a warp drive, and it's just on the wrap somewhere. That wouldn't surprise me.
Well, wouldn't that be terrible if we didn't know that, huh?
Yeah, I know. We couldn't handle it. All right, we're down to the last few minutes here, and so let's just take a quick switch of gears, and we're going to wrap the show up, and hopefully that this new time frame that we're in from 9 to 10 o'clock is a little better for folks. We're going to stay here. We're going to try to – we did that to open it up to our West Coast listeners because of the three-hour time difference. So hopefully this is a little better for folks. Next week, Mike Jones is going to be back hosting the program with the alien abduction phenomena, so you want to join us then. We've also, as you probably are aware, if you've been to Paranexus.org, we've been making some changes to the site. We have changed the look a little bit, kind of rotating the top header picture every few days to make things a little bit more interesting. And we have featured videos and so forth, and we have a gallery. So if you're a Paranexus member, you can upload different videos and different things. You can even, if you find an interesting video on YouTube or Medic Cafe or wherever, you can usually embed those in the gallery, and if it's a good one, we'll feature it on the front page. We've got our blogs, and if you haven't started the blog yet, just, you know, that's for members. So if you're not a member, we'd love to have you. And that leads me to another little change that we just made on, just a little tweak on the memberships and dues. We were using an aspect of the software that just wasn't working out, so we kind of consolidated it and made it a little simpler. So if you'd like to share the Paranexus vision, we're an association. We're trying to gather people of like mind to do research and share concepts, much like Stephen has been sharing tonight. And Stephen, thanks for being a member. We appreciate that.
Well, not at all. I really enjoyed talking with you guys. So yeah. Thanks for the opportunity.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, it's been an interesting show. We've got some other ones coming up, too. And if you know of somebody that would be a good guest or you feel like you would be a good guest, give us a holler. I mean, if you've ever done a radio show, you know that getting guests is always, you know, an effort. So we're looking for interesting guests, and bearing in mind that not only are we looking for philosophical things, but we're really looking for ideas and concepts and techniques and tools and tips and so forth to help anomalous research. So we're looking for thinkers. Come and join us at paranexus.org if you haven't already. We've got certification courses, and here's another quick announcement. I just released a new leadership series yesterday. Now, several folks have taken the certified leading paranormal certification course for founders and directors. It's basically a comprehensive leadership course wrapped around the paranormal field. So that's an excellent course. But not everybody may want to take the entire certification course. So what I've done is I'm offering now a whole leadership series. If you have one part of it that you really would like to get some information on but don't want to take the whole course, you can now do that. The, for example, screening and interviewing members, excellent information in that. Dealing with difficult behavior, there's just a couple of the different books. There's 8 in all. You can look at the titles. It's all there on paranexus.org, and members get, of course, discounts for being members. So, some different things. If you see anything that you'd like to add to the site or any features or anything, let us know. We're open. And come into the forums and post your ideas. We've been getting some interesting things posted, some different videos that Mike Jones has posted on and kind of explained. So take a look. Stephen, we really appreciate the time tonight being a guest. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Doug. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope it was food for thought for a few people.
Yeah, sure it is. And our listeners, as always, we appreciate the time you spend in listening to us each week or listening to the archive version of this program. Until next week, we appreciate everybody. We'll see you then. Grant, you have a good night, too.
Hey, good night, everybody. Shuttle's coming home tomorrow from the mission to the International Space Station, too.
Cool.
We're going to wish him luck coming home. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Universe.